Good afternoon, everyone. Patrick Brenner here, President of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Thank you so much for tuning in today for another episode of SPPI TV. We are here today with Professor Catherine Spilley. She is a, hang on, I don't want to mess this up, Catherine. Hang on just a second. Professor and Endowed Chair at San Diego State University. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Spilley. It is a pleasure to have you on with us. And we're going to be talking today about the recent Supreme Court decision that was handed down just last week in the Hallin v. Brackeen case. And we're going to talk about why that is such a victory for tribal sovereignty and so important for protecting and preserving the rights of tribal governments across the country.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here and especially thrilled to bring some good news from the Supreme Court. Of course, all of us that follow, you know, and work heavily on tribal rights and tribal sovereign issues, you know, we've been anticipating this, but actually a lot of our talking points have been on the other side, really not anticipating a victory, to be honest. And so it's pretty exciting to redirect and come on your show today to talk about the victory that we did have, and also, you know, to look forward to some of the threats that might still remain that might be out there that are or almost indicated by some of the language in the Supreme Court decision. So I'm really honored and happy to be here today to talk about this with you.
Thank you so much. We were talking about all of the other really pressing issues that have come up in the last several weeks with the Chaco Canyon issue and the oil and gas problem that was encountered by the Navajo Nation. But the good news with the Hallin v. Brackeen case is so important and so critical to protecting tribal sovereignty now and in the future that we're going to focus the entirety of our conversation on that today. So what is the case from your understanding, other than it's a consolidation of several cases? It was the Cherokee Nation v. Brackeen, it was Texas v. Hallin, and it was Brackeen v. Hallin that were all consolidated into the single case of Hallin v. Brackeen. Arguments were heard in November of last year, and then that decision was handed down on June 15th.
Right, and I do have some slides to walk people through it if this is kind of new to them, but I also can kind of give a summary up front to make sure people stick around. Really what the case was about before I go through the slides was about three questions. One was, did this Indian Child Welfare Act, which was signed in the 1970s, did it overstep congressional authority with regard to tribal affairs? Number two, did it commandeer state actions and state law in an unconstitutional way around the 10th Amendment? And number three, did it violate equal protection with regard to Native child placements? And so, you know, the short answer is the Supreme Court shot down those first two and said, absolutely, Congress has authority to do this, that the federal interest in Indian country and in tribal rights preempts the state law and the state interests in every case. Number two, it's not anti-commandeering, again, because of that significant federal interest in tribal affairs. And then three, the equal protection question was really just relieved on standing, saying that this wasn't the proper venue since those who were brought in front of the court were not those implementing the law, and that was, you know, kind of something that would have been more appropriate for a state at the state level, since that's where these things are implemented. So it did leave the equal protection hanging out there, which is one of the things that we'll follow up with in terms of dot, 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 what should we be worried about in spite of this victory lap, that there's more caution ahead and more work to do.
Right. Let's talk about where the case originated, though. What are the details surrounding it? My understanding is that there's a family that is located in Texas, and they were trying to adopt a Native American child into their family, and the tribe that Native American child belonged to objected.
Correct. Again, this is a husband and wife in Texas, the Brackeens, hence the name, and they had adopted two Navajo children, and they are non-native and certainly non-Navajo. And the Navajo Nation basically said, well, we want to place them within a family in our community, and that is the federal law gives us the right to do that. Since we do have families here that want this child, we have the ability to preempt the state of Texas and their law regarding placement. And so the Brackeens sued, saying that that was, again, it was unconstitutional, that there is a federal law that says this. Number two, that the federal law basically dictating and taking that child out of the Texas state placement sort of process and removing that child to go back to the Navajo Nation, to that child's own community, was a commandeering act, which, violates the anti-commandeering statute. And that number three, there was that the best sort of the best interests of the child weren't being considered, hence equal protection, because the tribal rights were dominating. So they had several arguments. As I mentioned, two out of the three were completely dismissed and sort of smacked down, but the equal protection question was simply put aside under lack of standing.
Sure.
So interestingly, of course, this family has another child, and they're back in litigation in Texas now with the same attorney. So I think that equal protection question lingering, there's going to be another bite at the apple, as they would say.
I want to make an analogy here, and please tell me if my analogy is incorrect. But what this is equivalent to an American family trying to adopt a French child out of Paris. It is the a child from that is a citizen of a different nation, and if France intervened in that adoption, it's the same as the Navajo Nation intervening here. These are sovereign nations, and that's something that I don't understand the typical conservative rhetoric around that, why they're so unfriendly to the concept of tribal sovereignty in the United States. And that's something I'd like to talk about today, specifically why organizations that are friendly on a lot of things, but not friendly on this issue, like the Goldwater Institute, why they're taking such a strong position against the interests of Native American tribes.
You raise a great question, and one that I, of course, have, I've been involved in tribal affairs my whole life. I'm not a tribal member, but I was born and raised on the White Earth Indian Reservation in Minnesota because my parents were teachers there. So I went to school there. My whole childhood was there till I was 18 and went away to college, and my whole family's still there. And so, I mean, I've been immersed in the question of tribal sovereignty versus the sort of civil rights model that most Americans are used to. So again, I think that's the biggest challenge is education. Like you said, I love your analogy of France, for example, that's another nation. That's one of the sovereigns that the US has a government-to-government relationship with France, the same way that our federal government has a government-to-government relationship with our American Indian nations. And so many Americans, I mean, again, we don't learn this as a matter of course, sadly. Again, education in this country, there's a big fight about that right now. What does a good citizen need to know, and where and when should they be learning it? But that's a whole other interview. But I think there's so little understanding of the unique status of tribal nations, and that it does derive from the fact that they predate the Constitution, that they're extra constitutional, and their role specifically is named in the US Constitution as a nation akin to France with regard to this nation-to-nation status. But I think, like you said, well, why would anyone object to that? Why is that a bad thing? Why are there groups that want to impose on that or even erase that distinction and redefine it as racial, which is what this case was about, was redefining tribal nations, which are political entities, as racial categories. and therefore having this racial preference, which we know is illegal, right? So it was a way to try to create that path. So you're saying, well, why is that? Why would anyone want to do that? Well, I think there are several reasons. One is just trying to erase the specialness of the tribal federal relationship. I think the other thing is that the US really is, Americans, if you will, really are raised in this civil rights model that the 1960s, you know, we have the Civil Rights Act, there's this sort of democratization, and the ethnic group status is something that is kind of naturalized, even in the way, again, I'm a college professor. So we have ethnic studies, we have an ethnic studies requirement. Well, what is ethnic studies? We have African American studies, Asian American studies, you know, Latino, Latinx studies, and then we have women's studies, but we also have Native American studies. So that kind of implies that there are these ethnic groups, these minority communities that we need to study as part of the melting pot of America. But that is not true. That is not how American Indians fit into the system. Tribes are their own nations. So it's just different. And sometimes when things are different, people want to erase those differences and make everybody the same again, especially when those rights can be exercised with regard to commerce and business. So for example, tribes have casinos. Obviously, we haven't talked about the fact that I run an institute called the Sequan Institute on Tribal Gaming, and that I get questions every day. Why do tribes get to have casinos when other people don't, right? So there is this special status as nations where tribes have their own authority to go into certain businesses that are state regulated, like gaming, like banking, like insurance, free of state regulation. So that status as nations does have other repercussions that some of our business competitors don't like, that maybe some states don't like because they want more control, just like they want control over Native children and placements. So this special status that tribes have retained because they were indigenous here, all of America is on their land that was alienated from them through various means. So erasing that becomes the goal of business competitors, those who simply don't understand or don't like this type of special status, and again, other government entities among many, many, you know, opponents of tribal sovereignty. And it's discouraging, especially, I think that's something else that came out about this case, through this case, was, you know, the amicus brief process really forced some of the opponents of tribal sovereignty to sign their name on a piece of paper and put their views down on paper. And we can read that and see that. And we know now, you know, I hate to say, you know.
Well, Kate, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Now we know who the enemies of tribal sovereignty are. They have penned their name to a piece of paper, and we've got a list. So we know who the opposition is. And that's a good thing.
I think that's been very illuminating for a lot of our tribal communities, and kind of a little bit sad how vehemently the opposition has been demonstrated. And again, on what terms, right? Writing about people's children, about breaking up Native families, about, you know, re-traumatizing the separation of Native families, as we know, is one of the root causes of the historical trauma that continues to resonate in our tribal communities. And to say, you know, we don't need to worry about that anymore, or that's no big deal. I mean, and as really almost a front for some of these business interests that I think are behind some of this, it's pretty demoralizing. But I think also, you know, to me, what's been a little upsetting, if you will, is just I've been involved in tribal politics and the federal version of tribal politics for over 25 years. I used to work on Capitol Hill. I worked for a congressional committee on gambling policy. I worked and represented tribes. I've been all over DC, and I've worked with many, many state governments. And you know, we always like to say we don't have any permanent friends, and we don't have any permanent enemies, right? We always want to keep that open. Where are there ways that people can come together and see that, you know, tribal empowerment is also your empowerment. How do we create these win-wins? But I don't know if I can feel that way anymore. You know, I mean, I really, really felt that, and we cultivate that. Tribes, I always say tribal governments that I, my interpretation, again, this is my opinion, is they don't play offense. They really just want to protect what they already have, take care of their own communities, strengthen, rebuild, invest in themselves and their neighbors. They're incredibly generous at the state level, at the regional level, at the local level, but they don't go after other people. They don't go after others. They want to protect themselves and maybe just continue to assert the rights they already have that they haven't been able to necessarily afford or been empowered to actually enact, even if they've had the rights all along. But I don't know if there's such a thing as no permanent enemies anymore. I think it's pretty, it's going to be pretty hard to forget what some of these groups said and did and wrote down and submitted to the Supreme Court, and possibly will come back with even more vehemently next time. So again, I think that that's been one, but I also want to, you know, stick with the positive that the list of friends is unbelievable. And some of the briefs submitted by the American Medical Association, the American Association of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, the Casey Family Foundation, I mean, the research, the decades of good work and science that they were able to forward was cited by some of the justices as very important for tribal communities and for, again, this recovery from federal policies of boarding schools and termination and relocation and family separation. So again, on the other side, we do have an incredible list of friends who were able to really put out, you know, really powerful research that validates what tribal communities already know. But of course, it always helps to have a lot of friends and third parties and academics and practitioners weigh in and say, yeah, they're not just saying this from their own experience. That should be good enough, but it isn't always good enough. You know, unfortunately, that the research bears out that children, you know, suffer if they are removed from their communities, and children thrive if they remain in their communities, and that we can show both of those things, and that we have these very powerful groups weighing in on our behalf in these amicus briefs. So that's one of the things I want to point everyone to is, you know, sort of the Gorsuch 43 pager and the briefs by, you know, the AMA, the AAP, the APA that really are great reading, and those are resources for us moving forward.
Did you include any of those samples in the PowerPoint presentation?
Let's go to those slides so I can just kind of walk through and catch us up on some of it, because I do want to get into a little bit of the weeds since this is your, you know, hopefully we have some public policy folks on here who want to get a little bit into the weeds. So again, I need to really give credit to the Sequan Institute on Tribal Gaming. They're located at San Diego State, the first ever tribal gaming institute at a university. This is the chairman of Sequan, the Sequan Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. They're based, well, of course, San Diego sits on their Kumeyaay territory, and they established the institute to do research. We have a four-year degree. Many people do not know that there is a four-year degree in tribal casino operations management. I teach that degree program in concert with, of course, all of our tribal nations to do the practitioner training, a lot of internships and other, you know, interactions with our local communities. We also do research and public policy on tribal gaming issues. So again, I won't go into it, but we have five courses that are specific to tribal casino operations. They're all online. So if anybody does have an interest, they can take any of these courses from me anytime, including one on gambling addiction.
And if I need to move through these slides faster, just tell me.
No, this is fine. I just want to give a taste of kind of where I'm coming from in my current position.
Of course.
So the next slide is, I believe, again, just to really boil down, what do you study when you do a four-year degree in tribal casino operations management? And like you alluded to at the very beginning, we really double down on the fact that tribes are governments first, but those governments don't tax. The tribal government does not have a tax base to operate. So the tribal governments need to run businesses in order to fund basic services. So like any government, the tribe has roads, schools, they have hospitals in some cases, they have social services, they have fire, they have law enforcement. How would a government pay for that if they don't have a tax base? Well, our tribes have to operate businesses. In this case, casinos, gas stations, restaurants, hotels, resorts. So it's an incredible balance that we talk about, that return on investment from the business is then plowed back into return on community through the government investment. So that's kind of the umbrella of all the courses feed into this larger challenge and opportunity of tribal gaming. So that's how I pull the students in too, because they love both sides. They don't want to just work for a business anymore. These young people today, they give me hope. They really want to find meaning. So working
this
in tribal
is, this gaming is what really got our relationship going. You and I were introduced by a mutual acquaintance, and you offered about an hour deep dive into nation building. And that was, I went through college and I didn't take any of these courses. I studied business administration, and I do regret not taking some of these courses to find out more about your area of expertise. And that hour-long presentation that you gave me, I think it was in January, really opened my eyes more than I ever thought possible on this particular issue. That was a groundbreaking moment just for me personally in my career and in my leadership at the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Thank you so much for that. And this is a continuation of that. This is great. Folks, pay attention. Pay attention. Kate's going to go over some really great stuff.
Well, again, I could do a whole other interview on that, but that nation building is really what this is all about. And of course, again, back to ICWA and the court case that we're discussing, this was a direct attack on that nation building, because it was an attack on tribal nation status itself. It was literally trying to redefine tribal nations as races, as a race, as an ethnic group, and undercut their special status in the Constitution, in federal law, the trust relationship they had with the federal government that derives from treaties and sort of the four corners of the Constitution. So again, we can't do nation building if we're not nations. Right. And educating about that nation status through what tribes are doing with casinos is really the passion that I carry to my students and to anyone who will listen, frankly. So again, thank you for having me here, because believe it or not, there are a lot of people who don't know this or frankly want to know this. And I appreciate that. Hopefully your audience does. And especially in this, you know, in the Southwest, of course, this is where some of our great tribal nations are and doing amazing things. So, you know, the case itself, if you want to move forward, it was a win. Like I said, none of us were really prepared to go on about, wow, we won. So just having this today it feels a little preliminary, because we're still reading and everybody's still kind of processing it. But I know I cried. I know many of us did, because it was relief and gratitude, and especially some of the language. Again, I haven't had a chance to go deep, deep, deep yet. But what I'll pull out today is some of the very powerful quotes. And yet, even though, you know, people were taking victory laps, you know, like I said, tribal leaders, tribal representatives, tribal attorneys are very much about defense. So it's back to work as well. So the next slide is about just, you know, what is ICWA, right? You hear the ICWA case or the Indian Child Welfare. It really has a few provisions. One is it's a federal statute from the 1970s. It was signed by President Carter, and it prioritizes adoption of American Indian children back into the tribes themselves, ideally the tribe for where the tribal child is enrolled. But if not that tribe, then another tribe first, that there is a whole priority list to keep that native child in Indian country. It also is very powerful in that it allows the federal government to set the terms for American Indian adoptions. Again, keeping those native children out of the state system. This is very similar to why do tribes have casinos? Tribes aren't subject generally to the state law on anything. why would they be subject to the state law on where their children go? And the whole point of ICWA, and it was in the 1970s during what we call the self-determination era, it was really a reversal of the prior era, which was the termination era, where tribes were being erased, where tribal communities were being broken up through relocation and through the boarding schools, where literally families were separated, children were put in boarding schools, and in many cases died there, or at least had their, you know, connections to their families and their communities severed. And that is still being repaired, if it can be, in many of our tribal communities. So ICRA is a very, very powerful statement of federal preservation, of tribal community strengthening, and separating tribes from states. So that's what this was sort of all about. So the next slide talks about, you know, the Brackeens. And again, they had adopted some, you know, two children from the Navajo, that were Navajo. And the Navajo Nation basically said, no, we want them back here. And the state of Texas says, well, we are in charge of children's placement. So you, Navajo Nation, through the federal government and through ICWA, this federal law, can't come into our state and tell us how to place this child, because this is a state issue. And so the family and their attorneys challenged ICWA, saying it was unconstitutional because Congress exceeded its authority by creating ICWA, because it commandeers state agencies to basically give up the child out of their state process back to a tribal nation, whether they want to or not, and that it therefore it violates the equal protection principle because it's not allowing the state to determine the best interests of the child, and it's doing so based on race. So again, that equal protection really is kind of the most serious of the three, because it does try to redefine tribes as a race in order to make the case of equal protection rather than sovereign immunity, which is a whole other category. So the next slide shows that, you know, what did the Supreme Court say on these three things? First, you know, it really is about redefining tribes as a race. And as I mentioned, you know, I think it's easy for most people to kind of go there because they think, well, yeah, I mean, that's this ethnic group model, this civil rights model is what Americans are used to. But that it takes effort to learn something new, and to understand that there's a whole other world here, that Indian country, Native nations, the U.S. Constitution. As I mentioned, where do you learn this? Maybe you get a class in college and you get lucky. Maybe you run the Southwest Public Policy Institute and you hear it from me many years later. I mean, yeah. It's really kind of ad hoc. I grew up on an Indian reservation, so I was lucky. I was immersed in this. I've studied this in college, but I get so many of my students in college, Native and non-Native, and they say, they just get upset. They're like, why didn't I learn this before? You know,
what if I didn't go over any of this when I was in high school, and I graduated high school in Los Alamos County, 13 years ago. And we didn't cover any of this. I mean, we didn't cover it in the state history classes. We didn't cover it in any of the government classes. It was woefully insufficient, didn't address any of this. And I thought that was a tremendous oversight, given that in order to leave the city of Los Alamos, the town of Los Alamos, and head down to Albuquerque just to go to the airport, you're transiting through multiple different sovereign nations on the way. And the fact that they didn't address that for any of their students, and it's not covered in any of the curriculum mandates, is an oversight.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I love when my students get riled up because they just say, why didn't we learn this before? This should just, everyone should know this. And I said, oh.
Kate, I'm already getting riled up. Stop it.
Okay, so keep going. Believe me, you'll get excited and then you'll get scared. So, I mean, the thing that was very hurtful about this, but also, frankly, I felt very diabolical and possibly was going to be successful. I think this is what all of us were worried about with regard to talking points if we lost, was that, you know, opposition to tribal sovereignty is ongoing, right? As I mentioned, we have business competitors in the casino industry who are frankly very frustrated that tribal governments can operate casinos where maybe they can't. Certainly oil and gas companies are frustrated or jealous or envious of tribes that have drilling rights, like in North Dakota or the Southwest. So there's a lot of opposition by business interests. And like I said, states also don't like to feel like they're losing authority on many issues, whether it's banking or child placement. They just don't like feeling like they need to cede any of their power or money to tribal nations. So when opponents have taken us on, tribal rights on in the casino context or in the oil and gas context, they lose. Even water rights, generally they lose. And so a lot of that has come back to the Indian Commerce Clause of the US Constitution, saying this is the source of the tribe's special relationship. Tribes are not a race, they're not an ethnic group, they are a nation. Just check out the Indian Commerce Clause. So over the years, the opponents, especially some of the business opponents in gaming and oil and gas, realized, well, then let's go after tribal rights in a non-commerce context. ICWA deals with children and adoption. Children are not commerce. I mean, this was literally the implied point of the case. Why ICWA was in the Supreme Court was to try to gut tribal sovereignty by using native children. So that, to me, was incredibly diabolical and frankly very dangerous, because it was a new tact that nobody knew for sure what was going to happen. So the next slide shows what did happen. Again, this is where one of the big victories, it basically says the Indian Commerce Clause is not just about commerce. It's about all areas of Indian affairs. So right there, that's a massive win. And that Congress's power to legislate in the area of federal Indian law, Congress does have the authority to pass ICWA. It's plenary and exclusive. Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution, which is called the Indian Commerce Clause, provides authority to preempt traditional state 10th Amendment authority over family law when Indians are involved. It couldn't have slapped it down more clearly that it doesn't matter if it's about business. If it has to do with Indian affairs, it's within the spirit of the Commerce Clause, congressional authority stands, period. Again, a huge victory, because it was very unnerving to be attacked on a non-business case. But what was wonderful as well was they expanded on that and said, you know, it's also not only the Commerce Clause. There isn't just this one slender reed where we can go to the U.S. Constitution, to Article 1, Section 8. We also have the Treaties Clause. We also have the inherent principles of the U.S. Constitution that say these tribal nations predate this document, just like France does or England does, that the four sovereigns listed, you know, the U.S. states, the tribal nations, foreign nations, and the federal government, that all of these have equal standing. And that the federal trust relationship itself, all of these are the authority, produce the authority for Congress to act on behalf of tribes. So I love this quote. Again, I want to direct everyone to the Gorsuch 43-page concurrence. In adopting ICWA, Congress exercised that lawful authority to secure the right of Indian parents to raise their families as they please, the right of Indian children to grow in their culture, and the right of Indian communities to resist fading into the twilight of history. All of that is in keeping with the Constitution's original design. So again, even addressing the fact that this is trying to repair prior termination era policies, where fading into the twilight of history, how about being erased through federal action? So he's circling back and saying, in the past, Native American tribes have come to this court seeking justice only to leave with bowed heads and empty hands. No more. Very powerful, beautiful, easy to read. I encourage everyone to go back and read at least those 43 pages. So again, question number two was ICWA commandeering. Does it force states to do something they shouldn't have to do, since they generally oversee adoption and placement? Since ICWA does require family courts to give preference to members of the child's tribe or even another tribe. And in these three state actions, which are active efforts, placement preferences, and record keeping, states are saying, well, we shouldn't have to do or not do any of these things based on a federal law. That's commandeering. And SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, said, nope, our federal interest in tribes preempts your interest in doing what you want to do in your own courts. Huge. Again, I love this quote. Thus, when Congress enacts a valid statute, like ICWA, pursuant to its Article I powers, which it has, state law is naturally preempted to the extent of any conflict with a federal statute. End of story. Classic quote. Use it widely. So again, back to all, I think in addition to sort of revealing all of our friends, we also, it just shows how tribes came together. Again, we have 574 federally recognized tribes. 497 tribal governments signed amicus briefs. This is the most of any Supreme Court case ever. There's just nothing like coming together around tribal children, tribal families. Look at this, 23 states, 62 tribal organizations. LA County, they do more tribal adoptions than any other county in the United States. They see how well ICWA works. 87 members of Congress, many tribal organizations. Again, these are some of our newer friends that I mentioned earlier, the AMA, the APA, ACLU, KC Family, ABA. I mean, go back and read what they wrote. The science, the support for family strengthening is incredible. But I wanted to say that Gorsuch even cites one of the APA briefs saying it is generally in the best interest of Indian children to be raised in Indian homes. Indian caregivers are better able to transmit shared norms, values, and cultural knowledge, which contributes to the resiliency of Indian children. So again, this is in the best interest. Equal protection, this is actually in favor of protecting and encouraging tribal communities. So, and in fact, that there's trauma of if you remove them, which would be the opposite. So here's our list of those who came out strongly against ICWA. The Pacific Legal Foundation, Cato, Goldwater, you know, the National Council for Adoption. These folks are, I think, incredibly hanging out there now. With what they've written, how active they were. I know that before many of them submitted briefs, many tribal communities, tribal leaders tried to go and talk to them and say, please don't write this. Please don't publish this. Please don't come out against us. And they said, oh, we know we're right. Right to our tribe's faces. It was pretty unbelievable. And if you go to the next slide, I think that one of the reasons that some of these groups are so powerful or so frankly, you know, dangerous in the future is that they do pose as think tanks. They're very active in legislation. They have scholarships and try to recruit people to help with white papers, and they put on events, and they have a lot of emotional appeals and pull people in that maybe don't really understand. Like you said, we try not to think of them of having any permanent enemies, but it's easy to recruit enemies when you're dealing with some of the heartfelt issues like adoption. So I do believe that, you know, that's why I think tribes were so active trying to go to some of these groups and saying, do you really understand what you're doing here? And they said, yes, we do. And we're doing it. So with excitement, but also trepidation. This was the Wall Street Journal opinion just 2 days ago, 3 days ago. The justices save the Indian Child Welfare Act for now. And wow. I have it right here, in front of me, because I read the hard copy. And Kavanaugh hints in a separate concurrence that the equal protection issue is serious and should be carefully considered if it returns to the justices through state court litigation. Again, kind of a foreshadowing, perhaps, especially if you go to the next slide. And we see that, you know, there's an opening here. Even Tony Barrett, who wrote the, you know, majority, she said that it was not properly before the court for procedural reasons. And the Brackeens have now raised the issue in a related case currently pending in Texas. So they had plan B. And the same attorney who's going to go back maybe another time. So again, tribes, I think, are definitely more vigilant now. We do have our list of anti-ICWA amicus groups that we can follow at the state level, since that seems to be where they're coming from. And like I said, it's just, there's so much happening. It's still very new. This was kind of my preliminary overview that I wanted to share with you, just to bring people back in who haven't been paying attention, or who maybe saw it and didn't really know the deep contours. There's so much more here even than I even can get to in a week or week and a half. But I'm just so grateful for you making the time on your show to talk about it.
So much for joining us. I really appreciate it. I was really disappointed to see both Cato Institute and the Pacific Legal Foundation on the list of anti-tribal sovereignty advocates. And we already talked about the Goldwater Institute, and I'm really disappointed in the right of center liberty movement really taking a concrete stand against tribal interests. I mean, I thought they were for limited government and protecting individuals, and you'd think that they, because of that, they'd be siding with the tribes. But here we go. They've signed these briefs and they've definitively made their position known, and we've got a list now of organizations that are handily opposed to the best interests of tribal nations across the country. That's really disappointing.
Well, and like I said, I know, for example, the Gila River Indian community, you know, they reached out to the Pacific Legal Foundation, you know, again, trying to talk to them and say, you know, do you really know what you're doing when you come out against ICWA, when you say that this is race-based? Like, we are the great Gila River Indian community, like, learn about us, see that, you know, when we have an interest in an enrolled member being adopted out of our community, there's a federal law, this is the federal, you know. Again, tribes are very open to maintaining friendships. They really don't want an enemies list. They don't want any permanent enemies. They don't want any, you know, we know we don't have any permanent friends. And so it's been a little bit confounding of, you know, these groups really doubling down, even when tribal leaders, tribal communities have gone and explained, and tribal advocates like myself and others have really tried to say, like, do you really understand? Because we do know that people can get caught up in the emotion of family law. I mean, again, that's why this was so terrifying, that maybe the emotion would spill over to the Supreme Court. Luckily, they came back hard with you know, justice, and doubling down on the four corners of the authority of Congress and tribal nation status. But, you know, this was definitely unnerving, just that there's so much awash of emotion here. And when tribal leaders would go in and say, don't you understand that we want to bring this child home? They still sent the briefs in and left the language. So there's a lot to learn by reading all of this.
Well, I hope at this point you understand that you have a friend and an ally with the Southwest
Thank
Public
you.
Policy Institute. We certainly
you.
Consider ourselves advocates on your side of this issue and on the side of tribal governments across the country. Just in the nick of time, prior to our show today, yesterday, I had a piece published in the Albuquerque Journal, and one of the key phrases that I want to pull out of there really quick was, I'm really proud of this one. ICWA considers tribal membership in the preservation of Native American heritage, ensuring that these children are not forcibly assimilated into non-Native households. I stand by that statement. Doubly so today than ever before. Dr. Spilde, it was a pleasure having you on. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to episode 14 of SPPI TV Indian Country. You can learn more about Kate at katespilde.com. I'll get that up on the screen really quick. Kate, I know you have something else going on this afternoon. I want to be cognizant of your time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much
for your support. I had seen that in the Albuquerque Journal, and thanks. I mean, perfect timing.
Yes.
And again, thanks for the support in writing, for putting us on today. And I'd love to come back on any topic. I really support all the work that you do.
Well, I hope that we can get you back on sooner than later. Thank you again so much, Dr. Spilde.
Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was episode 14 of SPPI TV Indian Country. My name is Patrick Brenner. I'm the president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. SPPI is a 501c3 nonprofit. As a result of that, you can make a contribution to the Institute at donate.southwestpolicy.com. Contributions to the Institute are tax deductible. You can join us every Friday. Every Friday, we live stream episodes of SPPI TV at 1 o'clock p.m. Mountain Time. We go live on Facebook, on YouTube, on Twitter, and LinkedIn, and everything else. And then we syndicate the episodes to your favorite podcasting service. Well, hopefully I can get those all done before Saturday. But thank you again, ladies and gentlemen, so much for joining me today. You heard from Kate Spilde discussing all of the great victories that were present in the Supreme Court decision in Halland v. Brackeen. We're very pleased with the decision of the court, and we stand with our tribal allies at the Southwest Public Policy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again so much. You all have a great day, a fantastic weekend, and I will see you next Friday.